and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Michelle Jacks. Michelle is a devoted mum of two who has lived with ARFID since her son started weaning. Through her own experience of supporting her son with ARFID, she has become a passionate advocate, working tirelessly to raise awareness and support others navigating life with this complex food intake disorder. She is also the founder of ARFID Life UK, where she raises awareness of ARFID by sharing her family's experience. Michelle is an absolutely incredible human. She is such an amazing advocate, and it's just so inspiring to speak to her and hear about all the hard work that she is doing. And I just so hope that the future for Michelle and her family is as bright as she is, because they are so, so deserving of a life free from ARFID. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Michelle Jacks, who is returning for a third episode on the podcast, which is extremely exciting. So thank you so much, Michelle. It's lovely to have you again.
Thank you so much for having me for the third time. I think we're just talking too much.
Yeah, no. Well, I think, I will always remember when we first met on and didn't actually realise who we were. I think that moment, like, it was such a lovely connection that we had. And I think it's just gone from there of just being even more lovely.
And I think actually it was strange, wasn't it? It weren't until after we was like, oh my God, I've actually just met you in person and hadn't connected the two and two together. But actually I think that was quite nice because it was the weird way around of meeting someone.
Yeah, it was actually like
not normal.
The first time we met was actually in person rather than it being online, which nowadays is wonderful that so many people meet online. Yeah. But it's often, I think it's a bit unusual now when you meet people 100%. In person for the first time.
Definitely.
Amazing. So the listeners may have listened to your episodes before. They may have listened to your podcast as well. Would you like to introduce yourself just in case they haven't heard of you before?
Yeah. So I'm Michelle and I do run ARFID Life UK. I've got a now 6-year-old son who has got ARFID. He was diagnosed when he was 3 and a half, but kind of ever since, really most probably ever since we introduced food, we just kind of knew that there weren't, I hate using the word normal, but it wasn't as standard as, you know, the process we would expect it to be. You know, this is our second child. We just thought, well, we'll progress through food normally. He'll have the purees and then we'll go up to lumps and bumps and textures. And that's kind of where we hit a bit of a roadblock. He just, the sensory aspect, he didn't like the temperature of food. He didn't like the lumps and bumps. He just didn't like it at all. We had a lot of quite a bit of a gag response. We now obviously understand a lot of it was a disgust response, but obviously at the time I had no clue what it even was. He just, from then on really, his diet was quite restricted from really a very young age, but it was always put down to sensory. He was kind of put on the pathway for autism, but that never really got anywhere because obviously the waiting times are so long. He was kind of diagnosed with that after ARFID. But yeah, he just never really went past eating soft food. Like even now, he wouldn't eat anything that's rock hard. He wouldn't have anything that's a temperature. Everything's cold. Everything's snacks. Everything's crunchy and crispy. He's just always been like that. And I think we didn't know what ARFID was. It was mentioned to us from a dietitian when we actually got discharged from one service to another because we'd moved. And I was just a bit like, okay. So he meets quite a lot of the criteria. I had no clue what it was. And I think that's the weirdest thing, isn't it? Especially coming, it weren't like I'd gone out and tried to find it myself. Like I didn't go down the Google search or reaching out to people. We was told by a dietitian that, you know, if we was to meet in 10 years' time, he would have ARFID. And I was like, what is that? And if anyone don't know what it is, it's avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And that's kind of what stemmed me looking into it. And I think actually, if he'd have never have mentioned it, I do wonder what would be different now, like in terms of how we would have gone about it. I don't really know, but we had no idea it existed.
Mm. And I think still now, you know, us being in this world, we know a lot more about it, but I think it's still something that is very under-recognised. I'm just interested, if the dietitian said to you, if they met you in 10 years' time, it would be ARFID. Why in 10 years' time? Why not?
I don't know. I think it was most probably because he was discharging me. Yeah, discharging me from his service, and just thought maybe if we ever cross paths again,
right,
that would be the conversation we have. But to drop that bomb on a parent, it all made sense. Like once we started looking into it, I was like, wow, you know, he met the criteria sensory wise, and then our interest in food. And then about a month after that, he had tonsillitis and blamed the pain in his throat for the food. Basically, he was just like, this food's really painful. And I was like, no, your throat is painful, you're poorly. He couldn't just understand. And then he just dropped food altogether. And he literally just lived off milk and yogurt. And I was a bit like, okay, you've now had the trauma response to food. And I was a bit like, you're now ticking all boxes, and quite extremely as well. Like he had gone from having about 8 different foods to 2, or one being milk and just yogurt. And it happened so quickly. And then it just stayed like that for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And that was when I was a bit like, okay, we've gone from managing to this is making a massive impact, a huge impact on his life.
Mm, absolutely. I'm really interested because you obviously said that he met like all the criteria, but the trauma response, it sounds, obviously came later. Would you say, I mean, you might not know this for gospel, I guess, but is this something that you think that your son was born with?
I don't really know. I think it's really hard to say, isn't it? I think, you know, with autism, like he is diagnosed autistic. Now he has obviously got that too. You know, autistic eating is a real thing as well. You know, you can have sensory issues with food, but that doesn't mean you have ARFID. And I think there's a massive crossover at the minute. And I think, like you were saying, it's still so relatively new. There's not much research. People don't really know about it. Unfortunately, at the minute, people are going, oh my God, my kid's got ARFID. They most probably haven't. It could just be that they're an autistic eater or struggling because of the sensory aspect. I always say with ARFID, for us anyway, in our own experience, it's like it's extreme. Like his is so stuck that, you know, we are having some wins, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, but it's taken us a very, very long time to get there. And I do kind of think maybe the sensory aspect was always there and most probably always would have been there. You know, he hated having his hair washed, you know, hated having wet food or wouldn't play with slime. Like he's always been funny with that kind of thing anyway. But yeah, maybe he has had it. But then actually the older he's got, the more my husband has, not he hasn't opened up, his mum has, about how he was when he was younger. They're very similar. Mm. So then I'm like, hang on a minute. The hereditary side, it could actually be that it was maybe he did potentially have that autistic eating, sensory-based eating, and then the trauma. And actually, as he's got older, he's very, the trauma is all medical based. As soon as he's poorly, we lose everything, no matter when it is, what it is, it goes. And I think that's the hardest thing we're having to deal with, is as soon as he's unwell, he stops eating, which obviously is dangerous because you need to eat. He doesn't have the reserves to keep him going. It's quite, that's the trickiest part. And I think the sensory stuff you can manage. You know, we can manage that. We can kind of work with what he likes and what he doesn't work. But I think when they've got trauma to being unwell, you can't stop them being poorly. Well, you can try, but it don't work.
And, I mean, I guess I'm making an assumption here, but with him not having a huge repertoire of different foods that he eats, I'm guessing there's maybe some malnutrition there. So illness is something that is more common when you've not got enough food.
Yeah, like his iron levels have been low, I reckon, since he was about 18 months old, and they're still now not really where they should be. His body just doesn't hold it. I do think predominantly, obviously, a lot of that is down to the amount of milk he drinks, because obviously milk affects your iron. It doesn't absorb it in your system. So I get that's why it's low. But yeah, his bloods have always been up and down. They've not been horrendous, but he kind of comes under the failure to thrive category. Like his weight on a scale, you can see when he's unwell. It kind of goes at one level and then it plummets because he's been poorly, and then it goes back up and then it plummets. You can just see when he's been unwell. And I think that's where it kind of, it does become tricky to manage, because you just can't, and like you say, he's so much more susceptible to being unwell. And then as soon as he is unwell, it's not just, oh, he's got a cold. It's like the extreme. His body just can't cope, yeah, which then is quite scary.
And I suppose that's the horrible thing, isn't it? You know, when you've got that trauma response and that anxiety around it, the way to kind of navigate that and to heal from that trauma or that anxiety is to not have the expectation of, you know, how the negative consequences that you have associated with that. Yeah. But when you're ill, you know, and, you know, like you said, it sounds like your son doesn't just get ill. He gets like very ill because of the malnutrition and things like that. So it's just reinforcing that, yeah, those thoughts, which, yeah, I can imagine is so tricky.
Yeah, because we always said, like, when he went down to just having milk and yogurt, I always said to my mum, if he's poorly again, we're going to lose the yogurt and we really will be in a tricky situation. And it did happen. You know, we ended up, he woke up one morning and I was a bit like, something's not right. And it was about 3:30 in the morning. And, you know, and you just think, hang on a sec. Like, he was sat on the toilet. He was doubled over in pain. And I was a bit like, I wonder if you're really badly constipated. Like, he's always suffered that way anyway. Didn't really think. I thought it was more that than anything. But he just plummeted really quickly, like, nudged my husband and was like, I'm taking him to A&E. Like, he's really unwell. And they x-rayed him. And bless his little soul, he was just full. Like, he was completely impacted, severely impacted. So they kind of admitted him on the basis that it was that, and they was like, you know, we'll do a disimpaction routine, wanted him to drink like 12 sachets of this stuff. And I was like, I won't even get a mouthful in him. Let alone 12 sachets. I was like, I don't think you're kind of grasping what's wrong with him. Like, he won't just have that. And then that was a battle in itself. Like, obviously the hospital didn't understand what ARFID was. They thought I was crazy. They was just like, get him to drink it. And I was like, would you drink 12 sachets? Most probably not. I'm like, so why would he? You know, considering what he's going through, he's not going to drink it. And then it wasn't until we'd been there for a few hours and my mum was like, he's just not getting better. And she was like, and if he's just impacted, why is he this unwell? Because he was so poorly. And it wasn't until one consultant come round and looked at him and she went, I'll be back in a minute. And my mum was a bit like, what's happening? And I don't know whether it was, she could just see it in his face or what. And she rushed back and she was like, we're going to go and get him scanned. She was like, I think it's his appendix. And we was like, pardon? Like, completely threw us out of the blue. Wow. Like, my husband had just turned up with my daughter and she was a bit like, what is going on? And within 20 minutes he was in surgery. Like, they were so quick, it completely shocked us all, because none of us was expecting it. They took us straight down to we had a scan, and even the bloke in the scan room, he said, no one touched this child but mum, because he was in so much pain. And I suppose the bloke could see what was going on, but they still wasn't sure if it was his appendix or not. So they was like preparing us for all these different scenarios of what it could be. And they just whisked him off to surgery. Wow. And it was his appendix. And they wonder if where his appendix had got a bit aggravated from potentially being so impacted that it, you know, all just all together. But he'd had tummy pains for a very long time. And actually looking back, I can see it. And I said to my husband, he always complained of tummy ache. And I don't know whether that was maybe grumbling appendix, or was it where he was so constipated that it was all just, it weren't happy. But then, yeah, our worst scenario become a reality and he stopped eating. And I knew it straight away. He come back from surgery. And I think it's that smell in your mouth, or not smell in your mouth, but you know what I mean? All the drugs. He's had a tube down his throat. Everything's just so sensory overwhelmed. Like, even when he breathed, I was like, God, you stink. Like, it was just, everything was so overpowering. And I gave him a yogurt and he literally was just, he was like, no, don't want it. And I was like, that's it. It's gone. And everyone was like, no, give him time. And I was like, no, I know him too well. I was like, it's gone. And it was completely gone. We struggled to get milk in him, but luckily he did eventually have it. But yeah, it just, we lost it. And it was just, then you start to think, okay, so we struggled before, but now we're just down to liquid. We are down to a solely liquid diet. And that was quite scary, because he was very unwell. Like, he had dropped a ridiculous amount of weight in a few days. The dietitians prior had never seen him in person. I refused to leave because I was like, I'm not going anywhere. I was like, you know, looking at him physically, this child is seriously unwell. was like, without even anything else that's going on, I was like, just look at him. And when they saw him, they were like, he can't leave. And I was like, finally, I've been speaking to you on the phone for all of this time. Yes, on paper, and this is what's frustrating for a lot of people, not just me, on paper, they fit the boundaries, you know, their weight and height is okay, or they're on a good centile, but physically in person, it can tell you a completely different story. And it did with Arlo. He did not look like the person that was on paper, and it was scary. But they won't take me seriously. And it wasn't until we hit that point that they were like, okay, we need to, you know, get him to have supplements or potentially a tube, like an NG tube at the time. But thankfully, after, I wouldn't say pressure, but it was from me, because I said to him, this is your options. You've got a tube gun up your nose, or you drink this drink. I was like, I don't care if I'm scaring you, because this is a sticky situation. You have to drink this. And bless his heart, he did. He never got up to drinking a full bottle. Like, we always mixed it in with his milk, but I think he could see the fear in my face. I think he knew that the best option was just to stomach drinking this drink. Mm-hmm. And thankfully he did. But long term, it still weren't enough.
Mm. And I guess I think that's quite an interesting point, because, you know, when I've spoken to people and yourselves about often before, it's very much, you know, not applying that pressure because, you know, you don't want to scare and things like that.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of the situation if somebody's got, you know, enough safe foods that feels comfortable, that they can survive and they can have the right nutrition on that. But as you said, you know, when you get to that point where
it's survival.
Yeah, exactly. And how did that feel to have to kind of, you know, put that pressure on?
It was really hard. Like, I think any situation like that, I think, well, I do especially, it's like my body puts a bit of emotional blanket over it. And it's like I have like a bit of an out-of-body experience. It's like I'm not really there. It's like this other person's dealing with it and everything else just gets locked away. And it was quite hard. And I think at the time we just had a referral accepted at a feeding clinic. So I was like, okay, could this be that we can get our appointment quicker? Because obviously the situation we're in, and we couldn't. They was like, no, you still got to wait, which really frustrated me. But I'm just really grateful that he did drink them drinks, to be honest. Like, if he didn't, I dread to think what would have happened. Or, to be honest, he would have had an NG tube, which really would have been, is what it is, you know. But I reckon he ended up being on them supplement shakes for, so he had his appendix out in July, and I think it was the April when we finally saw the complex feeding team and they referred him for a PEG because of obviously the situation he was in. He was petrified. He screamed at us. Like, I won't forget, we walked out of the hospital and he screamed at my husband, like, I am not having this PEG. Like, he was going nuts. And we just said to him, look, I'm going to be honest, unless you start eating, mate, that's where it's going. Like, we can't stop this from happening. It's too dangerous. And we kept saying to him, if you become unwell again, even if it's a cold, you are having nothing in your body. Like, this is, you know, when you're down to just one thing, my God, that is precious. Like, you will not, as a parent, I wouldn't let anyone near him. I was really wary of like anyone being around him with food, because I was like, if you put that milk off, we're in a completely different situation to anyone else. And people don't get it. People are like, oh, well, I'm sure he must eat something. And I'm like, no, he genuinely don't eat. And that was the toughest part. But then he only did try and start eating once it sounds awful, scared him again into having a PEG. And he did for a short space of time, but then after a while, it just stopped again. And it's kind of, I think it's the momentum, isn't it? I think a lot of it, and we worked that out after a while with the psychologist, who was like, once the momentum was there, he was, okay, I'll eat these skips or I'll eat a couple of things. But I think where his body was struggling so much and had done for such a long time, his ability in his body and how it affects your brain and all things like that wasn't at a level to allow him to. So it was short-lived. It was like for short stints, it weren't enough. And I think that's why we really struggled. And yeah, he now has a PEG.
And I think, you know, speaking from my own experience, which is different, but I guess, you know, there's still that fear around food, the mental effort needed to, you know, to continue to eat, when you've got those sensory aversions and everything, to Joe Bloggs on the street, going and eating food, is it doesn't really require any energy at all. It doesn't really require any thought. But when there's that level of anxiety and fear and trauma, like, it's just, you know, I completely agree with what you say in terms of that momentum at the start. You're like, yeah, I'm going to do this. And over time, it's like, but this is just, like, this is, it's more difficult. More difficult than anything I could ever imagine. So you've mentioned that Arlo now has the peg.
Yeah.
Do you mind just explaining what that is for people, just in case they don't know?
So the peg is a gastrostomy tube. He's got a little, they call it a fricker. It's quite cute. He, bless his heart, has named it Mr. G.
Oh, which was, my God.
I think the hardest part was trying to explain it to a six-year-old that you're going to have a tube put in your tummy, because as simple as it is, that's what it looks like. He's got a tube poking out of his stomach. And we got told very, very, not last minute, but he obviously got referred in April and I didn't hear anything. And I don't know how long waiting times are for surgery. You wouldn't, would you? It's not something you generally would know in life. Mm-hmm. So it got to, I think it was maybe August time. So I just dropped him an email and I was like, can I just ask, you know, how's this referral going? Like, what's the wait time? Like, just for my own head. And 2 weeks later, he had surgery.
Wow.
Yeah. So whether I had given them a bit of a kick up the bum or what, I don't know. But it all of a sudden moved very, very, very quickly to the point prior. So once I'd emailed and said, like, how long is it? I thought, well, I'm just going to start having conversations with Arlo. I actually bought a couple of books because I thought, if we can read a story that mentions feeding tubes, it's not directly coming from me. So I was like, it might not be as scary. And that's where actually Mr. G came from, one of the books. So we kind of started talking about that. You could see his fear of having one had gone. So we had gone from, I don't want a feeding tube, to I could see he knew he needed it. Like you're saying, like, mentally, I don't think he could cope anymore. I think he knew in himself he needed that help because he just couldn't carry on the way he was. Like, it was impossible. So, yeah, we just kind of spoke to him a lot about it. And I think he went in for surgery on a Tuesday and I didn't actually tell him he was going until the Saturday morning. So he had 3 days notice himself because, you know, both my kids are autistic, but they're both very different. Millie likes to know everything, the ins and ins and outs, where the postcode is, what door I'm going through. And I thought, I can't tell her too early because I didn't know all the answers. And because it happened quite quickly, everything was changing all the time. Like, I was getting phone calls and emails and everything just happened so fast. She knew something was wrong. She knew something was going on because she could just tell from my body language. And she was like, Mum, you're not telling me something. And I was like, I'm not telling you because I don't know the answer. Yeah. I was like, once I know the answers, and I made her this social story, like a book of everything for her, where she was going, because obviously she was meant to be at school, but didn't go to school because I was just like, I can't mentally deal with that. I was like, you're better off going to nannies for a couple of days where I know that you're going to be with someone that can support you too, because she struggles a lot with her own anxieties and her own emotions. I was like, it's not just us going through it or Arlo, it's also her, you know, it's a knock-on effect on the whole family. So she obviously went and stayed with my mum. So they made plans. So then I had everything written down of, like, what you're going to do with nanny and granddad. And thankfully the hospital actually did, they wrote Arlo a social story. So like where to go in the hospital, like what it looked like, where he would go, like everything that he would see, what the peg would look like. So it was quite a lot in 2 weeks, which I also then again, my body is very, very clever at putting up a block. I just went into this military mum mode of, I need to get this organised. And bearing in mind, the surgery wasn't local to home. We had to go into London. So that in itself was not an issue, but I also then had to arrange that. You know, I was like, we can't get the train up there because we've got to get him home. So we had to drive. So it was like booking the parking, booking hotels. Like, it was just the whole thing in a two-week space of time was so intense. And then you're also trying to be a mum. And I think that's why I told him at the last minute, because I was ready. I had everything packed. Everything was sorted. Everyone was organised. Everyone knew what they were doing, where they needed to be, where we needed to be. That I thought, right, I can tell the two of you now together and deal with really the final bit of it. And I do think looking back, that was the best thing we did. Like it wasn't, he didn't necessarily have too much time to think about it, which to be honest, he shocked everyone. He was incredible in hospital. Like my husband still now to this day, if he was to speak to him, would say he doesn't want it. But now I can see why he has it because it has made a big difference. I think when you're in those conversations, it's the hardest decision to make as a parent because you're making that decision for him. You know, it's not Arlo can say yes or no. I'm making the decision to have this put in him. Like it was soul destroying. It was awful. And I think even as in a relationship perspective, me and my husband, like that's hard because I had one mindset of this is happening and he's like, but I don't want it to. So then it's like the arguments, you know, like it is just, it's a huge, huge decision to make. And I don't think people realize it can be soul destroying and it is hard work. But actually, once we'd gone to hospital, and Arlo literally is the bravest kid I think I've ever met. He's like a little warrior. Like the resilience that kid has is insane. He did not batter an eyelid. He walked in that ward, got in that bed and took it all in his stride. They literally was like, I've never had a child be so compliant to anything. They were like, we need to do your blood pressure. And he was like, okay, just put his arm out. Like the anaesthetic lady come around and she was talking to us and he was really listening. And then we walked down to surgery. I'd got him like a little gown made with cars on it. So I was like, that might make him feel a little bit better. So he wandered down there. This gown was massive because he's only little. He got down there, he climbed on the bed and he went, do I go to bed now? I was like, not yet. And he was like, oh, I won't watch my tablet. I'll just lay here and close my eyes. And the lady was like, no, let's just have a little chat first. He was not bothered in the slightest. And she just put the little mask on his shoulder. She was like, can you smell it? And he was like, yeah, it's not too bad. And then he went, you can put it on my face now. I was in shock. Absolute shock. Like my daughter's been put under general for like her hip problems. And I have come out of there heartbroken, like sobbing because it's been horrendous. Like I had to wrestle her on one of them, like proper full lock because she just hated it. Mm-hmm. He just laid there, closed his eyes and went to sleep. Didn't flinch. Didn't murmur. She said to me, normally they kick out, like it's normal, like don't be freaked out by it. And he just literally went asleep. And even the woman was like, I don't know what this kid's doing. She was like, he's the calmest kid I've ever met. He just didn't batter an eyelid.
Do you think he knew?
He knew.
That it was going to really benefit him and he just kind of needed to.
Yeah, 100%. He knew. Like, and even when he come round, it kind of took a while to come out of surgery. And he was a bit dazed. And then all of a sudden he went, can I see it? And I was like, I hadn't seen it myself either. Like my husband looked and nearly passed out, which we was all a bit like, oh my God, how the hell is he going to cope? Because he's quite queasy. And to be fair, so am I. I've now got a stomach of steel. I didn't prior, but I do now. And I was a bit like, are you sure? Like, do you want to look now? And he was like, yeah, go on then. And he was like, oh, it looks quite cute. He just was very, he had that in September and what we had January. It's only now that he's used to the feeling of it. It's taken a very long time. And I think that's the sensory side of it. I think it's kind of, because he's got tape on it to hold it so it doesn't move. If I take the tape off, he panics because I suppose it moves. You can feel it. You know, it's kind of, without gross, it goes in and out, but it's you know, it can't feel pleasant. And I think, bless his little heart, he has been so incredibly brave, which I think has made it slightly easier on us, I think, because I'm like, God, if you can be this strong, then I need to put my big girl knickers on and I need to man up. Because even like when the nurses were coming around here to check on him and to check that it was okay, they was even like, oh my God, this kid's insane. Like he just, they'd be like, you ready, Arlo? And he'd be like, yeah. And he just flipped his top up, would batter an eyelid. When he went back to school, like on a really reduced timetable, I said to people, he needs to come with a bit of a trigger warning because he literally was just like, look, think, can I pre-warn people that they're going to flash? splashing his tummy, there is, like, you know, Mr. G in there. Little friend. But in a way, I'm quite glad he's like that. He's kind of like, he's got a good relationship with it. He doesn't see it as a bad thing.
It sounds like he's proud.
I actually think he is quite proud in a way. And I'm really proud of him. But I think, most probably for a good year and a half, I knew it was coming. I think because his intake was so slim and I knew obviously everything was very medical trauma based, I knew there was no other option. So when they told me, I was like, okay, whatever. Didn't get upset because I was just like, I knew that was really the only option to potentially get his body back to where it should be to allow him to eat. And I think, you know, when you have such a prolonged time of malnutrition, you know, it does affect your cognitive ability, doesn't it? It affects everything. And there was no way whole milk was going to give him that. And a bit of supplement shakes, you know, that isn't going to build his body back up. And actually now what goes through his peg, to be honest, is exactly the same as what he was drinking before, but he's now getting the whole amount. Whereas before, you know, we was mixing it. He would never drink the whole bottle. I couldn't force him to drink the rest of it because, again, it's pressure.
Yeah.
Whereas now he has it through his tube and the difference in him is insane. And it is like we've hit 2026 and his body's gone, ta-da! That's you, where I'm going to change mummy's, I don't know, like it's just been a bit of a whirlwind the last few days. And I genuinely think, thinking about it, and I spoke to a couple of other people, I genuinely think it's down to the pig. I think it's the fact his body is no longer starving itself or nutritionally struggling. It's no longer malnourished, that he just feels comfortable enough. And, you know, we do live by a no pressure, no anxiety. I basically ignore him around food. Like, we don't talk about it. You know, we've all changed our language around how we speak about food. Like, even my daughter, we basically ignore him is the best way of putting it. And I think because we had all of that in place and we've had it in place for such a long time that he knows there's no expectations for him to eat. And he's just decided, I might start eating.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
So it's through mad. Through having the peg, he's started to like actually physically eat himself as well.
Yeah. And I think I haven't told loads of people he's got it. This is the first time I've actually really spoken about it properly. And a lot of people assume that when you have a feeding tube, especially a peg, they can't eat or they can't drink. And I think there's this assumption with feeding tubes that you don't eat alongside them. Well, you can, you know, it doesn't stop you from continuing. Yes, I get that, you know, you're having it for the reasons that you're not eating because of X, Y, and Z, but it doesn't mean you can't. And actually, really, just from this last week, the difference in him around food is bonkers. Like even yesterday, so he started eating these Ella's Kitchen Melty Stick crisps. You know, everyone's worst nightmare. You walk in a supermarket and that one food that they've decided to try eating is out of stock. So I was like, and normally these moments happen when they're not with me, but actually he was with me and I was like, oh, hello, they're out of stock. And he was like, it's fine. I'll get the different coloured packets. So wow. I kind of looked at Millie and I was like, okay, what ones do you want? So he picked up all three, stuck them in the basket. And went, it's fine, I'll eat one when I get home. And I was like, yeah, I've heard this so many times. Like, how many times have you told me you're going to eat something? Kid you not, we got home, we opened the packet and I ate the whole lot. And then an hour later, got the other packet out of the cupboard, a completely different flavour, and ate that whole pack too. To the point, my face was exactly the same. I was just sat eating my own dinner, just in shock, thinking, hang on a second, you've not just eaten one completely different flavour, you've just eaten two in the space of 15 minutes. You know, and you just think, wow. And even like when he was eating them, he was having one and he was a bit like, oh, this is a bit spicy. Because I think it was tomato and basil. But he was like, it's nice though. Carried on eating it. And then the next one, he went, oh, it tastes quite similar. So he just carried on eating it. It's bonkers. And I just think, is this genuinely down to the fact that he's got a peg? I've got no idea. But whatever it is, I'm taking it as a massive win.
You're taking it. I think, you know, it absolutely makes sense though, doesn't it? Because again, speaking from my own experience, which is different, but when your brain is starved, you do become very rigid, and also like anxiety is so much more intensified. Yeah. So if he is now getting nourished, then I mean, that's just absolutely incredible.
I know. And he started eating a Munch Punch yogurt. And I'm like, we now sit down for dinner and he sits up the table with us and has yogurt. I'm like, what is going on? But I said to my husband, because of his autism, he's not, I wouldn't say he's a rigid thinker, but he likes routine. Mm-hmm. So I said to him, like, these odd things that he's starting to eat, if we can get them into a routine, I think he would stick with them. So I said to him, every day when we have dinner, I always put him a place up the table anyway, knowing full well he would never sit there, but he knew he had the choice if he wanted to, even if it was to play or watch his tablet or whatever. But what I've been doing now is just putting the little Munch Bunch on a plate with his little spoon, and he actually comes and sits and eats it. And then once he's finished, it goes off. So I said to my husband, if we can keep that going, it will then become so into his routine, because that's what he likes. It should continue, because there's no reason for it to stop.
Yeah.
And I think our feed is so individual, that ain't going to work for everyone. Some kids won't even go anywhere near the table or be around anyone else eating. We are quite fortunate. He will be around us when we're eating. There is certain things you don't like the smell of, but he doesn't like the smell of it, but he will still sit with us. So in that sense, but then I think whether it's because we've been dealing with it for such a long time and I'd gone on such a research rampage of trying to find help, that we've been doing it from such a young, early age, that it's helped now. Like, I can see these things that we've put in place years ago have worked, because now he doesn't care. He just comes and sits with us. It's just now trying to keep it, like, I know this could all change in a heartbeat and I know this could stop tomorrow. Okay, I'm not silly. Like, the other week he was quite unwell and we lost everything again, but we had his peg. So I was just a bit like, it's fine. I can just put the additional fluid, keep him topped up that way. And within 2 or 3 days, once he was better, he started eating again. So it was, rather than him being poorly, going unwell, becoming malnourished again, I can stop that now. And that's predominantly why they did give him the peg, was purely because we can't run the risk of him being unwell and his body just keep plummeting, because he just, his body was too low in the first place. Whereas now, I do wonder how he would be again if he was unwell. Would it be that his body would manage a little bit better? I don't know. But whatever has happened, I don't know.
We're enjoying it.
We're enjoying it. And I just got into a bit of shock.
Yeah.
Because he's very chilled. He's very calm. He's not bothered. Mm-hmm. He just sits on his little beanbag and he just eats it.
Yeah.
And then the only thing I am worried about is that I said to my husband, he's, I suppose, never, like the interoception, he's never really understood being hungry or being too full. And I said, could we potentially then be having the opposite? That because he is now eating, could it become not obsessive, but like yesterday, he just kept going back up to the cupboard. I'll get another pack. I'll get another pack. And I'm like, hang on a minute. You can't have another pack. And actually, I was a bit like, I'm telling him not to eat. Like, this is not ideal. But at the same time, I don't want him to go the opposite. So I was having this conversation with the dietitian. She was like, there is a fine line between them progressing and then it becoming the opposite problem, because they're having too much. You know, she said it's a fine balance, especially even like with having supplements through the peg. You know, it could be that he starts to eat more. So we reduce that, which means then he's not so reliant on supplements because he's having more food. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't want him to then think he can just go to the cupboard and eat 4 packs of Skips, which I would be grateful for. But at the same time, he is still drinking a hell of a lot of milk. You know, like, there's that kind of setting him out then to understand that you can't just keep eating in case it potentially goes the other way. But then I think that's the overthinking of parenting.
And I think that is, as you said, that's such a tricky thing, because you'd never want to say to him, don't eat. But then if there's not that understanding of hunger and fullness, then that's a real challenge. And I assume, I'm not a parent, but I assume that's a kind of tricky thing that all parents go through, is like not wanting to tell their children that's bad for you, you can't have that.
Yeah.
But also, you know, you need to have things in moderation and things like that. So,
and we found yesterday, actually, went back to school And obviously he's been off school for the last few weeks, so it's fine, we've got all day. And he come home yesterday, and obviously his pedicure is split up. He has like half at night and then a bit in the morning and a bit mid-afternoon. And we had an appointment yesterday, so we come home later than normal. And I said to my husband, we've got a 2-hour window here where I need to get stuff in his peg. He needs to have milk. He then wanted to eat. I was like, there's not enough time for all of this to process in his tummy. I was like, he can't drink a bottle of milk and then I start pumping it into him because the milk's got to go down. And then he was like, I'll have another packet of crisps. I'll have another packet of crisps. And I was a bit like, whoa, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
And actually, yesterday I really struggled because I was a bit like, I need to do these things. And then I was a bit like, you need a good half an hour, 45 minutes before I take you to bed to then put more in you. It was that. And we have the issue that he won't eat in school. Mm-hmm. So he's going that time frame at school where he won't eat. He'll just have milk and they'll top him up. So then he's obviously hungry and I've only got a short window to pull it in. So I think this is going to, I think this will be the tester on now going forward, how we can try and gauge it. Because like you say, I don't want to be saying to him, well, you can't have that, because actually I'm just grateful he's eating something. But at the same time, it's hard, isn't it? There is that fine balance between trying to get him back into healthy ways. You know, there is, I don't want him to go the opposite. I don't want him to then start not piling on weight, but you know what I mean? Just so it's a healthy way of him recovering and a way that would suit him. It could just be we have to maybe mix up his pedicure, maybe do it all in the morning and all at night rather than in the afternoon. It could just be that we're going to have to really just play it by ear. Mm. Yeah, I never thought I'd really be thinking, oh, I need to stop him eating too much, because there is that fear, isn't it, that you don't, it's that cut-off point in their brain of not knowing when to stop because he just doesn't understand it.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so difficult, isn't it? Because I think from what you said, it is very much like that play it by ear. And
yeah,
I was going to say to you, like, oh, you know, what do you think the future could be? Like, do you think that, you know, he'll always have the peg and that can be something that will support him and he can eat alongside it? But I suppose it's one of those things that you kind of just got to go with it, and what will happen will happen. And I think we often spend a lot of time, and, you know, it's such a natural thing as a parent, as a family member, to spend time worrying and overthinking things, because of course you're going to, after what you've been through for the past few years. But it's so tricky to know what's the best thing to do when there's so many different factors at play.
Yeah. And when we had the peg fitted, they said that they was like, this will continually change. They was like, yes, that peg is there, but how you use it or how often or how little, you could use it more times than other, you know, like when the weather changes and hopefully it warms up, you might find that you're putting more fluid through it, because he does, as much as he drinks loads of milk, where he's been eating more, obviously that's declining, which is fine, it balances out, but he's not very good at drinking water. So then we still have that fear of, you know, he's not drinking enough, he's not getting enough fluid. But obviously I know now I can put that through the peg. So I think it's all, and the nurses kept saying that, they was like, every day will be completely different. You'll have days where you think, everything's gone to plan, everything's gone to routine, and they said like the next day it can be completely different. And I think we have had that, we've had good days, bad days, everything in between, days where I just look at his stomach and burst into tears. You know, like, it is all just days where he gets really overwhelmed. I think you just have to, it's hard. I think anyone potentially going down this road, I think I never really thought about how much it would trigger the guilt. And it's weird. It wasn't until we was cleaning his tummy and I sobbed. My husband was like, what is wrong? And I was like, I'm not talking about it now, because obviously he's sitting here. Millie was sitting there. I was like, we'll talk about it later. And it was just like, I felt like it was highlighting the fact that I just can't feed my son because there is this tube coming out of his stomach. And I know it's the best decision we ever made, by far the hardest, but it doesn't make it easier. And I underestimated the emotions that it would bring up of how you feel as a parent. Because it was just, I'd still now look at it and I just think, Jesus, like, you bring a child up into this world to feed them and I can't. And now you've medically got a tube in your tummy. because of me, really. I feel like it's my fault, and I know it's not. I know none of this is my fault, but there is that little person inside your head that will every so often go, woo, I'm just going to make you feel like rubbish for 10 minutes. And then I do sit there, and I say it to a lot of people, allow them feelings, allow to feel like rubbish, allow yourself to feel like guilt. Let your body feel like it's your fault, because you will flip that around and you'll have a far better outcome in the long run. Because that's the only reason why I most probably could sit here and talk about it, is because it's made me more headstrong in the fact of, I know it's not my fault. I can also process those moments when it comes up. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, we are all human. We're all parents. You know, it's our child. No one wants it, whether they're eating or not, tube or not. You know, that guilt and that awful feeling that comes with it is tough no matter what process you're going through, isn't it? It's just, it is really, really difficult. And I think that's where it becomes hard as a parent. And I think that's when, even like with professionals and stuff, isn't it? You know, they don't really most probably understand how tough it is as a parent, because they can't fully see it. You know, they see you for 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, or even longer, an appointment. It's not enough time to really understand what someone's going through.
No, and I think, you know, unless you're living through it, you can't comprehend
the
impact, the feelings, the emotions, the guilt. And, you know I can sit here and say to you, but, you know, Michelle, it's completely not your fault. And, you know, the fact that you literally have dedicated so much of your life to raising awareness for ARFID, like, you know, you're just speaking about, you know, your life and the kind of things that you do in order to support your family and everything, like, you know, that in itself is just shows how much you care and what have you. So, but I know it is so incredibly hard, and that doesn't help. But I really like what you said about, you just have to sit with those feelings, because I think you're so right. You know, we could very easily say, oh, don't be silly, it's not your fault. But that's not helpful when you feel so guilty and feel it is your fault. But I think honoring those emotions and working through them, as you say, I think it helps you to put actions into place and say, okay, I am feeling guilty about this. I know it's not my fault, but what can I do to make it better? You can't fix it, but, you know, your support, I'm sure, is having so much of an impact.
And actually, that's why I started up my social media. I hit such a low point. I think it was when we got discharged, we moved house, no one was listening to me. I was banging on every single door going, and I was just like, I can't be the only person doing this. Like, there's got to be other people out there. And then when I started looking online, I was like, whoa, there was just nothing really mentioned about it. There was only an odd few accounts. And I was like, oh, I'll just set up an account, see what happens. And obviously still now, no expectations of anything. I just post things. And the amount of people that are going through the same thing, it does make you feel so much better. Mm-hmm. Or even just being able to say to someone, like, I've had a really bad day, or I spoke to someone the other day and she was like, I'm having a really rough day. And exactly what I just said a minute ago. I was like, allow them feelings. Allow it. Be annoyed. Be frustrated. I said, and if you are that frustrated, I normally, which I don't think my MP likes me too much, I normally email the MP. I'm like, channel that feeling and that anger into something else. And actually, we had one hell of a fight on our hands. Like, don't get me wrong, getting Arlo this peg and getting him onto this service was not easy. It broke me beyond belief. I can't even tell you the amount of time and effort it has taken to get to this point. It's been so incredibly hard as a parent, but in a really weird way, I wouldn't change it. And that sounds really bizarre, but it's not been easy. It's been so incredibly tough, but actually, by using that anger and using that frustration out on being like, no, this is not okay, you know, file that complaint. You know, email them back and say, no, I'm not putting up with that. Like, yes, I know there is no services, but where are they then? Where can you send me? There's got to be someone. Yeah. And, you know, not everyone can do that. And I think that's the hard part. There isn't many people out there who will even have the energy, most probably, to, you know, they could walk in their GP and they're going to hit you with, it's fussy eating, they'll grow out of it. And there will be then parents that just go, okay, and just leave. I would have most probably been that person years ago. But it weren't until someone annoyed me that it rumbled my stomach and I was like, nope, fire is coming out. And at the end of the day, they're so young. Yeah. They've got their whole life ahead of them. And yeah, I get off. It's still relatively new. There's so much has got to change. So much has got to change.
Well, and I think, you know, I feel like this is, it's not a weird thing to say, but I do think that sometimes these things impact people. I very much believe in like a higher power in the universe. And I think these sort of things impact people that are willing to stand up and make that change. And, you know, for the people that would walk into the GP surgery and just accept whatever the doctor says and not want to fight back, you know, you are creating that noise so that more and more people are finding out about it. And, you know, I very much would assume that if people are, you know, searching for the different symptoms or things like that, or, you know, what on earth is this thing that I'm going through, they'll come across your page and you'll give them answers. So I think the work you're doing is incredible.
And I get so many people message me and they're like, oh, I'm so sorry to ask you a question. Like, please don't reply if you can't. And I'm like, I'm a human being. I'm not going to ignore you. I'm like, my inbox is open to anyone. Yes, it might take me a while to answer. Or you might then get a random voice note back because it's just so much easier. But I've made friends for life through social media. Yeah. I think, and it's funny, we've got friends, obviously, but people don't get it. And I think unless you're living it, people still don't understand. And I think to have a relationship with someone that can listen to your 5 minutes of crazy or a little win that you've had or anything like that, that person that's going through it too will be so much more compassionate. They'll have so much more empathy. They will scream from the rooftops with you. Whereas friends we've had for a very, very long time don't get it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't tell them. And they're like, oh, I didn't know. And I'm like, because you don't understand. And I'm not putting any shame on friends. I'm not. Yeah. They know I feel like that. But they don't see it in that sense. They just see it as, oh, he's eating something. Great. I'm like, you have no idea what that means. But to someone else, it's a massive thing. And, you know, my inbox is always open, no matter where anyone is, what they want to ask. I don't care. I get asked sometimes the most bizarre questions. But I was that person asking the bizarre questions. I was that person thinking these things. And I think where it's becoming more known and there is more awareness out there, people are questioning more, is it ARFID? And I think it's a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing in a sense that I think people, I'm not saying people just want labels, I'm not saying that, but I think people do want an answer for what their child is like that. So they'll then find a word and would then really focus on that. And, you know, just because your child struggles with food, it doesn't mean they've got ARFID, but it could be the signs are there. And I think you've just got to be really wary. And the first thing I ever did was started writing a diary. Just as simple as jotting everything down, kept a note of everything, what he was eating, what he weren't eating, and just so that I had evidence so that when I actually, because he was only little, so I think I went to the health visitor and he was already under paediatricians from being unwell at birth. So we kind of skipped the GP, but then obviously went back to the GP when we moved, which was the when I then got really angry. But there is, it's just building up evidence and finding someone that gets it. I think it is, it's an incredibly lonely journey. But if I can share mine and it makes someone feel a little bit better, then that's a win in itself.
And I think that's, you know, the power of community, as you said. Yes. You know, you've got friends outside of it and, you know, they're friends and what have you, but having people that understand, I think, can make such a difference to not feeling so lonely. And I think the idea about keeping a diary is such a good idea because, as you said, I think always, you know, whatever eating disorder it is, whatever illness it is, I think it's always good to go to the doctor. You have that such a short period of time. Yeah. So if you go with, these are the reasons I think I've got this thing, then it can, you know, massively help to move things along. So thank you so much, Michelle. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you again. Where can people go to find out more about you?
So I'm on Instagram, TikTok and Facebook at ARFID Life UK. And if you want to listen to our podcast, we've got Three Mums, One Mission, ARFID.
Well, thank you so much. And honestly, I wish you all the best. I hope everything kind of continues with the positive trajectory that you're on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.